Hello and welcome to the Global Energy Transition Podcast, presented by the Heinrich Böll Stiftung European Union and the Global Energy Transition Blog. I am your host, Michael Buxbaum, lead blogger, photojournalist, and advisor to the energytransition.org. Though I am based in Germany, our podcast series reviews how the energy transition is developing globally while we discuss proposed solutions to the growing climate emergency. Like the blogs we publish, all our materials fall under a Creative Commons license and are therefore free for anyone to use, so long as you credit the material. As the climate crisis envelops us, we intend for this podcast series to inform listeners about progressive steps forward and new tools being developed to deal with what's ahead. Though we may not all be in the same boats, we all face the same gathering storm. For us to actually make any headway in slowing the speed or reducing the magnitude of climate change, we have to first understand what's driving us off this cliff and then change course, like now, actually. One thing that's been slowing us down, though, for decades, though, is that most of our attention and actions on climate, such that they are, have been around controlling greenhouse gases, yeah, but we've mostly focused just on carbon dioxide. And though CO2 from burning coal, oil, and fossil gas is indeed one of the main culprits behind global warming, there's increasing evidence that what's accelerating the rate and severity of change is actually another greenhouse gas, methane. Most listeners probably know that methane is the main component of so-called natural gas or fossil gas, which is burned to generate electricity or is used to make fertilizers and chemicals. Also, for many of us, natural gas heats up our shower water or is what our stove burns to make our dinner. But if produced or mined methane is not burned, if and when it leaks into the atmosphere, then that methane becomes a frighteningly potent greenhouse gas with actually more than 86 times the warming impact of carbon dioxide over a 20-year period. In that sense, methane traps way more heat compared to CO2, helping accelerate the speed of climate change. According to new data compiled by the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, by late 2021, average atmospheric concentrations of methane had reached a record of 1,900 parts per billion in the atmosphere. For some perspective, 40 years ago, back in 1983, just as global warming was becoming a topic of conversation, that figure stood at just 1,638 parts per billion. New studies show that methane now accounts for about 30 to 50% of today's global warming. And we know that global temperatures are only increasing. Not only was last year the fifth warmest on record in Europe, but the last 7 years rank as the hottest ever worldwide. And 21 of the 22 warmest years since human civilization has existed have occurred since 2000. Though methane does indeed come from various natural sources, or from decaying matter in landfills or cattle belches and farts, a huge and growing portion of the methane billowing into our atmosphere comes from oil and gas production, from fracking, and from pipelines and other assorted industry infrastructure. However, new detection equipment from satellites and on-the-ground systems and cameras are helping pin down where methane leaks throughout the oil and gas industry are occurring. That means we now have the tools to figure out how much and how often methane is escaping. So in theory, we can get to work. And the good news is that 2021 may have been the year that our methane problem finally broke through the noise. Various global leaders, including U.S. President Joe Biden, whose country leads the world in oil and fossil gas production, as well as the whole of the EU, which leads the world in burning and importing natural gas, aka methane, both are making efforts to start controlling it. Last November, at the United Nations climate talks in Glasgow, Scotland, the US and EU and more than 100 countries signed a methane-cutting pledge, promising to reduce methane emissions by some 30% by 2030. And the EU now is moving to adopt even stronger rules on methane. Ish. As we'll hear in this podcast series, this ish is because today in much of the US and EU and around the world, not only are there very few or no methane standards, but there are no agencies and very few government officials that are really responsible or willing to control that methane. Since Joe Biden's methane pledge is still pretty hazy, for this episode, we're going to focus on those proposed EU regulations, drill a little bit into how they may affect oil and gas production, and look particularly at what the situation is where oil and gas production inside the EU is forecast to grow. And for the second podcast in this series, we're going to talk with two of the world's most prominent methane hunters and hear what they, using specially designed cameras, are literally bringing to light about methane pollution throughout Europe and the United States. Stay tuned. We've covered a lot of ground in the intro, so let's dive right in by interviewing Tim Grabiel, senior lawyer with the Environmental Investigation Agency International. When we caught up with him in late December, he had just spent weeks drilling the need to control methane into a great many European parliamentary heads in Brussels. Tim, thanks for coming on the pod. Could you start by introducing EIA and yourself to our listeners and talk about your organization's work?
My name is Tim Grabiel. I'm a senior lawyer at EIA, the Environmental Investigation Agency. I've been there for over 10 years now, working as part of both their climate and oceans campaign. EIA is a nonprofit organization operational in Europe and beyond. We investigate and expose environmental crime and abuse. We have various different campaigns that include ivory, tigers, illegal timber, illegal trade in ozone depleting substances, and others.
Okay, could you talk about your organization's work then around methane? What are you investigating and what are you finding?
So we're active on methane. For the last few years, we've been acting off methane because it's a short-lived climate pollutant that has a disproportionate impact on global warming. And it is one of the levers that we have available to us to avoid 1.5 degrees Celsius, which would fundamentally change the planet as we know it. So we have been active at the international level, most recently in Glasgow, trying to promote a new global governance framework so that we can reduce methane emissions and proceed along a planned sectoral transition to alternatives in the main methane-using sectors. So that's at the international level. We also are very active at the EU level on the EU strategy to reduce methane emissions, which broadly covers three main methane-emitting sectors, so energy, waste, and agriculture, and we're focusing on the energy side because of the near-term reductions that can be had there. Most recently, we've seen a proposal from the European Commission. It's called the EU Methane Regulation, and it's targeting methane emissions in the energy sector, and so we're working to ensure that the measures there are robust, that they are fit for purpose, and that they also extend across the supply chain to imports.
Let's talk about the new methane rules recently published by the European Commission. They are very much like a bowl of spaghetti. So let's take something of a spaghetti Western type good, bad, and ugly approach. What's the good about these rules, Tim? What's the bad about them? And what's just plain ugly?
As far as what's good is we finally have some rules that would be applicable to EU actors on monitoring, reporting, and verification, MRV. Which is important because right now methane is underreported. The leaks and super emitting events are unknown. And so we need some sort of rules to help curb the methane emissions that come from our infrastructure and to reduce them. So we have an MRV framework that has been proposed, and it's building on a framework that exists at the international level called the Oil and Gas Partnership, OGMP. It's building on that, and it's seeking to achieve the higher levels of reporting that would get us down to actual emissions that are being emitted at the site level. So that's good.
Yep, that sounds good.
Another good aspect is that it includes mitigation measures, so not just monitoring, but mitigating. So there's mandatory leak detection and repair, which we call by the acronym LDAR. So we have mandatory LDAR that will be rolled out on oil and gas infrastructure and coal as well in the EU. And then we have a ban on routine venting and flaring, which is another source of methane emissions. So we have some rules, that's the good, that will be applicable in the EU.
So those sound really good so far, particularly the LIDAR bit, which we'll be discussing a bit later in the episode. Now, what about the bad?
The bad is that these rules could be strengthened, especially on the mitigation side. We like to see strengthened commitments on not only the frequency of LDAR checks, because how often you check for a leak is related to how often you find a leak, which is related to how often you fix the leak. And so right now the commission is proposing quarterly leakage checks. We'd like to see that be monthly. We'd like to see the timeframes for repairs to be accelerated. And we'd like to have a more robust framework on reporting and engagement with the competent authorities so that we can ensure compliance. On the ban on routine venting and flaring, I think that we're going to have some discussions on how we can narrow the exceptions that exist. So while we do have a general ban on it, there are several exceptions that are undergirding it, and we'd like to have some clarity to show that they're not abused. There are some measures that would look to address inactive wells and mines. I don't know if the audience knows this, but after the oil, gas, and coal have been exploited, we often don't have obligations to do anything to cap and fill the wells and the mines to ensure that they don't continue to emit legacy methane emissions. And so we have some provisions that would seek to survey those wells and those mines that would require member states to adopt plans to cap and seal them. But what we don't have are timeframes and clear obligations on who would do the capping and the filling, which we think is important. And in the instance of abandoned wells and mines, we're going to need some concerted effort to create a fund where ownership cannot be discerned to ensure that we don't have these legacy methane emissions.
Those methane emissions are, as we noted earlier, much more climate impactful than CO2, more than 80 times more heat trapping ton by ton than CO2 over a 20-year period. So those do seem pretty bad.
As far as the ugly is very ugly in our opinion. So these measures only apply to the EU, and the EU is a major importer of fossil fuels. So on the gas and oil side, the EU imports over 4/5 of all oil and gas consumed in the EU. On the coal side, the EU imports over 2/5 of all the coal consumed in the EU. And most methane emissions occur during the upstream segments of the supply chain, which means they occur outside of EU borders.
Outside those borders, meaning where that gas is produced, gathered, processed, and refined?
Yeah. The commission put some numbers on it. They said somewhere around 75 to 90% of the methane emissions associated with our oil, gas, and coal consumption occur outside of EU borders. And so given that we're such an important importer on the global stage, we import over half of all globally traded gas. Given that we're such important importers, and not to have any meaningful measures on imports, we do have a few provisions designed to try to bring transparency, but that's about it, and they're quite weak as they are. We're a bit disappointed to see that we are not trying to address the emissions that we've essentially outsourced to non-EU countries. So that will be a major issue that is considered by the European Parliament and the Council of the European Union. It's whether and how to strengthen the measures on imports. And that's the ugly. The ugly is that right now we don't have anything meaningful.
So then these rules only apply to a relatively narrow sliver of what is being consumed in the EU. As you said, they only produce about 20% of what they need there. So that means that these rules then do not apply to fully 80% and rising of what the EU actually burns and consumes.
None of the rules on MRV, on LDAR, or the ban on routine venting and flaring. So we could, in effect, see continued leaks and venting in non-EU countries, and yet we'll still consume the oil, gas, and coal coming from those countries. And so that's the problem. We have an ability here to condition market access, to use the power of the purse string to get some changes upstream. And that's where the European Commission really dropped the ball.
You just used the word could there, but I don't really get a sense of how these rules, as you have just described them, Tim, have any teeth outside the EU at all. What do we know now, today, about how much methane from the EU's major fossil gas suppliers is leaking into the atmosphere?
There is emerging data on this. We now have a new administration in the U.S., which is now working to curb methane emissions. And part of curbing methane emissions is actually understanding what those methane emissions are. And so the U.S. has proposed regulations that would help to get at this. We have satellites in the sky that are now showing huge periodic plumes from super emitting events that are occurring in this region as well as others. So we're starting to get a sense of the magnitude of the problem, but we don't have any granularity, as it were. What we do know, though, is, you know, these are problematic emissions. And if we are to continue to rely on these sources of methane for energy, we have to be very careful.
Careful to be sure, Tim, because we are fast losing the main thread of why exactly we as a society, both in the EU and worldwide, are supposedly switching from coal to fossil gas. It's supposed to be cleaner, right? And gas is supposed to be a bridge fuel to renewables. But methane is much worse than CO2 in terms of its heat-trapping potential. And so studies from the IEA, the other IEA, the International Energy Agency, and other groups show that when more than 3% of produced fossil gas, i.e. methane, leaks into the atmosphere, then gas becomes worse for the climate overall than the coal it's supposed to be replacing. So if fossil gas is a so-called bridge fuel, then, Tim, it's really taking us in the wrong direction. Surely the European Union, the European commissioners know we are butting right up against that line here, right?
Oh, yeah, we're right up against the line, if not over it. There are some estimates that the leakage in Russia, so before the gas gets to us, is somewhere around 3%, 3.5%. There's evidence that suggests the leakage that we have within the distribution and transmission could be one or higher. And so when you start to do the math and add the numbers together, we could very well be using a transitional source that's worse than the source we're transitioning from.
So we're going backwards.
Yes, we're going in the opposite direction. Now, this is not to diminish the need to move away from coal, which is a very known climate killer, but it just underscores that we need to transition to something else. And we cannot use natural gas, or what we call here in Europe, fossil gas, as a transitional source.
And of course, what's worse are these depressing data points from 2021. Coal burning and mining were way up, sending lots more CO2 in the atmosphere. And fresh data from NOAA shows that methane is now exceeding 1,900 parts per billion.
It just underscores the magnitude of the problem and how precarious our effort to stay within 1.5 really is, and how much we need to get on it, really.
We talked about detecting leakage, and one area the new rules do address is methane leaking out of abandoned oil and gas wells, as well as also inactive or abandoned coal mines. For the coal side of this, there is new reporting and better information, something that I do hope to cover in future episodes. For reference, I'll link into the show notes a recent study by the climate think tank Ember on methane leakage rates from EU coal mines, particularly in Poland and Romania, the latter of which we've covered quite a bit of late, and we'll dip into a little bit more in this show. But for now, Tim, could you talk more broadly about how these new methane rules apply to abandoned mines and wells?
The fact that we have inactive mines or wells is definitely on the radar. And it's one of the things that this EU methane regulation is seeking to address. Now, historically, there haven't been any rules. So historically, we haven't seen any actions. There's no surveying, there's no cataloging. We don't have a database of these inactive wells and mines. After a period of time, if they're particularly old, the methane emissions from them go down. But for those that are of more recent nature, I think there's a very strong argument to do something as quickly as possible.
Key point, who's in charge of monitoring and enforcing these rules? And what are the penalties for breaking them?
That is a good question. And that gets at the way the EU has structured itself. This regulation will apply across the EU. It will not need to be transposed by member states. It will have universal application upon adoption, which is about two and a half years away. Once these rules are in effect, member states, they have competent authorities. It varies by member state, but they have various competent authorities that are enlisted or charged with enforcing the rules. Now, this can include a series of inspections. This can include spot checks. It can include document review or just sort of following up on reporting. So that falls on the competent authorities of member states, as does the adoption of penalties. So the EU is hesitant to adopt EU-wide penalties. That is largely considered within the remit of member states. And so once we have these rules adopted, there'll be a period of time in which member states will be required to adopt some sort of penalty regime. Now, it's important that we get strong penalties, because obviously that's going to influence industry and how they foresee violations. We're quite concerned that we might get some weak penalties because of politics. We're going to be vigilant on the penalty side because we want to avoid weak regimes that basically make violations a cost of doing business and or do not change industry behavior.
We've been talking about proposed EU regulations. Let's look a bit wider. In November, around COP26, many nations adopted new methane pledges to reduce their emissions. But these are, of course, only pledges. Could you review a bit what this new, somewhat informal methane pledge is all about?
At Glasgow, there was a global methane pledge that was signed by over 100 countries that sought to reduce, or seeks to reduce, 30% methane emissions by 2030. Now, this global methane pledge covers the three methane emitting sectors, so it covers energy, agriculture, and waste. But most of the reductions are understood as being most feasible, most cost effective in the energy sector.
There's so much I want to discuss with you, Tim, but to help us wrap up, what's next for EIA? What should our listeners be watching for? What's next for your team?
This is going to be an interesting next 2 or 3 years. You know, we've had our methane moment in Glasgow, where methane burst to the scene and it captured the imagination of the public and policymakers alike. And so we have a moment of action now. We also have the very real prospect of crossing 1.5 degrees Celsius this decade. And so we're in a critical moment, an all hands on deck moment, and EIA will be focusing heavily on trying to get this EU methane regulation fit for purpose, applicable to imports so that we can have some extraterritorial benefits, not only reducing methane emissions here in the EU, but reducing methane emissions associated with our consumption. And then we're going to be very active at the international level, trying to bring everyone around a united vision on how we can go about progressing towards 2030 in a way that will keep us under 1.5. So that'll be the focus of our efforts in the next few years. As Executive Vice President Timmermans said in Glasgow, time is running out, but it's not too late, so let's get cracking.
Let's get cracking. Excellent. Thanks again, Tim, for your time and for sharing this with our listeners.
Thank you very much, Michael.
So, listeners, over several previous podcasts, we've looked closely at Romania and their ongoing energy transition. For the rest of this episode, I'd like to discuss how these evolving methane rules and pledges could affect them. And as we've discussed previously, Romania is the second largest producer of oil and gas in the EU behind the Netherlands. But unlike the Netherlands, Romania has repeatedly stated it has no plans, zero plans, to reduce oil and gas production on or offshore. Quite the opposite, actually, as Bucharest is actively pursuing avenues to produce gas from under the Black Sea. Though, as Tim mentioned, the new EU rules will apply only narrowly to EU producers, it's actually even more unclear how they will particularly affect Romania. And it also doesn't appear that Romania is an individual signatory to the US-led methane pledge either. To get a sense of the situation on and under the ground, I contacted a Romanian methane expert to bring us up to speed. Otila, thanks for coming on the pod. Could you introduce yourselves to listeners and tell us about your research?
I'm an energy policy analyst with Celsius, and I'm looking mostly at methane policy.
Okay, let's start with Romania's history with gas, with methane gas, and bring us up to speed with what's going on there today.
So Romania has been extracting oil and gas for quite a long time, so over 100 years. It has gas all over the place, but mostly concentrated in the center of the country. Most of the gas deposits which are currently under extraction are quite mature, and some of them are close to depletion. The future is mostly connected with the potential from the Black Sea deposits. So there is potential in the Black Sea for deep offshore gas. Mostly, the current production will very likely decline in the years to come. So if, for example, if the Black Sea reserves are not being put on the market, then probably Romania will start importing more and more gas. So a few years ago, we were importing about 10%. Probably by 2030, we would have to import about 50%. We have the potential to export in the region because if you look at the region, the consumption in the countries around us is quite small, so just a few BCM. So in the region, Romania could become a competitor for gas with the existing gas supplies, which are mostly from Gazprom, and very recently the Azeri gas, which is being brought through the southern corridor.
So Romania, which produces quite a lot of its own gas, is now also importing?
Yes, yes. For the time being, yes. In theory, from this year, we could import also Azeri gas, but the network in Bulgaria is not yet, let's say, strong enough to allow the transit.
And as domestic gas production declines, you'll have to produce more.
Now more and more. We are starting to import. I think this year it's going to be almost 30%. So the domestic production is actually declining quite rapidly, partly because of the natural depletion of the reserves, partly because of poor policies. So, for example, a few years ago, we had a policy which regulated the domestic gas price, which discouraged investments or encouraged the two producers to reduce production because it was simply not worth putting some of the gas on the market. So it's a combination. It's a combination of natural limitations and of silly policies.
Tell us about Romania's gas reserves. Do they have more reserves? What's it like? Or are they just not being exploited?
Well, the economy has restructured a lot. So for a long time, we were very energy intensive, and there were special facilities for some large industrial consumers of gas, particularly in the fertilizer industry, pretty much like in Ukraine, who were very well connected to the government, and they were getting cheap gas either from the state-owned company or by special regulation from both producers, the private and state-owned one. What has happened in recent years is that this industrial consumption has declined substantially because of the market prices on the gas market. But we are also, the supply is also declining, the output of domestic production.
There were some discussions about 10 years or so ago in Romania about fracking, but those plans have thankfully faded. As you've said, most of the attention going forward is either on producing gas from deposits off the Black Sea coast or imports, correct?
I think the government has this idea that there is going to be a lot of gas on the market because somehow, by some magic, all the gas that is available in the Black Sea will come into the market, and then there will be also the diversification in the region. So they are looking forward to expanding gas consumption, gas pipelines to households, which of course might be also a social issue because a lot of houses, particularly in the rural areas, are being heated now with wood stoves, which are not very efficient. They also emit particles, so there is a lot of discussion about that. But they also expect that at some point there will be substantial investments in electricity generation based on gas. But if you look at what happened in recent years, you don't see that much enthusiasm for private investments in the electricity generation sector. And this is mostly because the legislative and regulatory framework is very changing all the time with ad hoc ideas from somebody from parliament, or there is a crisis and somebody in the government has a quick idea that they need to regulate some price or change the rules of the game. So this is why you don't see any investment in the electricity generation sector since 2016. And in the gas sector, you see that the two companies, Romgaz, which is state-owned, majority state-owned, and Petrom, who is majority privately owned by OMV, they are not really accelerating investments. And at least for these deposits in the Black Sea, the discussions have stalled for a long time.
What about methane leakage from existing oil and gas facilities?
Of course, since all this infrastructure is so old, you cannot expect it to be leak-free, let's put it this way. So, of course, you have old pipelines, you have old compressors, older equipment, which is probably leaking. We don't know exactly how much they leak, because methane leaks have become an issue only relatively very recently, because they are much more difficult to monitor than, CO2 emissions.
I'm going to pause our conversation with Ottila here because we had some technical problems. And afterwards, when we dialed it back in, the interview started to veer away from Romania's methane story into their overall energy transition, something we've covered pretty well over the last few pods. However, new evidence on the ground shows that Ottila is absolutely right. Romania's aging fossil gas infrastructure is super leaky.
I was out filming and photographing different sites and seeing large rusted out holes in big oil storage tanks and rusted out holes in pipelines and on valves. So there were leaks coming from almost every part of the production area. Wherever there was a pipeline, wherever there was a valve network, I needed to look because it was pretty likely I was going to see something. I saw some pretty interesting stuff in terms of emissions in Romania.
That was methane hunter James Torito talking about what he found in Romania during the summer of 2021 when he, with support from the Clean Air Task Force, took a special camera to detect methane leaks into several of Europe's gas fields last year. In part two of this series, we'll hear much more from him, as well as interview another amazing methane hunter, Texas Sharon, who began hauling an infrared camera out into America's fracking fields nearly a decade ago, becoming perhaps the world's OG methane hunter in the process. Once again, I am your host, Michael Buxbaum, and you have been listening to the Global Energy Transition Podcast, a new series presented by the Heinrich Böll Stiftung European Union and the Global Energy Transition Blog. You can follow us on Facebook at global.energy.transition and on Twitter at Energiewende, G-E-R. You can find me at L. Michael Buxbaum. Thanks again to our guests, Tim Grable, senior lawyer at the Environmental Investigation Agency in Brussels, and Ottila Nuttu at the Bucharest-based climate think tank and media producer 2Celsius. Please look for links to both of them and the EIA's recent EU methane commentary in our show notes. Thanks also to the Energy Transition team in the EU office in Brussels, Lisa Tostado, Martin Keim, and Joan Lanfranco. Merci beaucoup for your edits and support, Dr. Seuss. And again, a huge thanks to the podcast's amazing producer, the sound guru, and benevolent ruler of his own banana republic, Christian Kreienborg. From high up in the hills above Hermigua, I wish you all smooth sailing on what may be rough seas ahead. Until next time.